Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell.
Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we welcome a CEO, Patrick Cullen from Arcle Resources. Hello, Patrick.
How are you doing, Mark?
Good, to talk to you. Good. How are you?
Yeah, very well.
Good, good.
Yeah, how are you doing, Patrick? It's Kenny here.
Kenny, catching up with Kenny as well. I've talked to Kenny a few times over the past few months. Interesting. It's interesting just to have someone to talk to when you're stuck at home in your office.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. How's the company coping, Patrick, in this kind of COVID lockdown situation?
Right. So, well, you know, obviously there's nothing happening on the ground at the moment in Ireland, although we're hopeful that we will get started sometime in this summer.
Yeah.
Working from home for me is not a big deal. I mean, I spend a lot of time traveling and working from home anyway. We've got an office up in Dublin, but I live outside, you know, I live in another part of the country, actually. Mm-hmm. The office has been working on a sort of, they've been able to isolate there. So that's okay. Look, I mean, you know, we're not a huge group, right? There's just a small number of us.
Yeah.
And we're scattered about. So I think, I guess we've improved some of the communications maybe in terms of the Zoom meetings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, guys like me will be used to doing meetings over Skype or Zoom, you know, sharing screens and investigating maps and plans and so forth. So maybe we're just more au fait with it. But yeah, I mean, it's working, isn't it?
Yeah, it is working. It's a new way, isn't it, for everyone? I think a lot of these online platforms are certainly struggling at the moment with a sudden rush of demand on them. But we have to work with them and try and adapt to this sort of new way of working, which, you know, from what I'm hearing, could actually be the same going forward for the foreseeable, particularly for the work that I normally do. I think return to the office might not actually ever happen. I think we've discovered we can actually work at distance.
Yeah, yeah, at least when you're working from home, you don't fall out with anyone. That's a benefit as well. But there we go. Patrick, so I believe you've had a bit of experience with COVID over the last couple of months. Any chance you can give us the backstory and what happened?
It's a bad flu is probably the experience I had. Of course, it's a lot more serious in many cases. I wasn't hospitalized, but I did pick it up. And I believe it was either at a conference or en route back home from the big mining conference at PDAC in Canada in early March, where in retrospect, probably there were many, many people, you know, who are the silent nature of this infection, I suppose, is the issue. People can pass it on and not experience symptoms or be infectious before they've experienced, you know, before they're displaying symptoms. So that we probably didn't understand as well at the beginning of March. Anyhow, yeah, so I came down with it and went into isolation at the first signs because I was aware, you know, I felt it very necessary to travel to Canada at the time, but I was aware, you know, maybe more aware of things like, you know, a little bit of a sinus and self-isolated. Spent 15 days, eventually got tested. And the result, I think, so probably tested about 10 or 12 days after the first symptoms and then tested another 8-9. The results came in end of March.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I'm well past it now. But yeah, I would say, you know, I think if you're in good health and that you're probably going to get through it okay. My wife picked it up. We think she picked it up. She lost her sense of taste and she had quite severe fatigue, and that was about the height of her symptoms. With me, I had the temperatures and the whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, through it, recovered. And we were just getting on with business. We did a cash raise around the end of March, you know, with all of that. So some trying times, I suppose. It's been you're just getting over something like that and you're on the phone for extended. Yeah. But it was, I suppose, I don't know. Could I say I've had some worse things, but I don't.
Yeah.
I wouldn't wish it on anyone. I think, I'd be very, very wary around elderly or, you know, people with underlying conditions.
It's good you got tested though, because I was ill with, again, flu symptoms at the beginning of March or second week in March. So was my wife, and I think four of our friends as well, all went down with it within about 24 hours, and none of us, you know, exhibited any symptoms when the previous hours when we were together. I couldn't get tested. I think the NHS here say that unless you're, you know, actually struggling to breathe, you know, we're not going to come and test you, which I suppose is fair enough. But I was working on the assumption that we'd all come down with it, because it was like a nasty flu. But until any antibody test comes out, I'm not going to know, am I, unfortunately? But it's good that you actually do know for sure that you've had it. It must be a nice feeling, I suppose, to know that you've gone through it.
It's, I suppose it gives you a sense, we don't know yet, but it gives you a sense that you might be, have some immunity.
Yeah.
But, you know, the full facts are still to come out around that.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, we're all waiting to see how this is going to play out. You know, I think we're expecting, you know, life has to go on. So things are starting to move here, and there's no fixed timeline, but there's a series of stages where we're going to move through. And I fully expect that we're going to be back in the field come June, July.
Yeah,
I would hope. We're expecting to be drilling in August. And I think that's that's quite reasonable. There's a caveat. I mean, it may be that there's a second wave, or for whatever reason, you know, we go back into lockdown. But the sort of logic we're working on is that in Ireland there's a strong focus on housing at the moment, social housing in particular. Construction industry is one of the industries that's receives a lot of headlines in the press around, you know, restarts. It's possible for people to work in those environments and be far enough apart, and we expect to see the aggregates industry opening up in response to that. And then, you know, aggregates means drilling, blasting. Drilling means, yeah, we can probably get a drill rig in a field in Limerick and drill for zinc. Why not? Of course. So yeah. That's kind of, you know, and I think, and it'll be great to get out in the field.
Yeah, definitely.
To jump in the car and driving, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the end of the street.
So just moving away from COVID, Patrick, obviously you're obviously a very experienced CEO, and you've been involved in mining all your life. Can you maybe take us back to some of the projects that you've worked on, you know, in the last sort of 20 years, or even further back, if you can go further back than that?
Well, I suppose, you know, I'm a geologist by training, by education. So I'd probably start there. And, you know, there's quite a long history of mining in Ireland, but I'll be honest, when I was a kid growing up, I wasn't really aware of it. You know, I think my interest in geology and that was more to do with, you know, interest my father had in like hill walking, you know, mountaineering, whatever, you know, standing on the cliffs of Moher and west of Ireland and sort of, you know, scratching your head and wondering, you know, how is this, you know, how did this come about? Or what, you know, why does things look like this, you know? And I say, you know, cause I grew up in the 70s in Ireland where zinc mining was really taking off, you know, with the Tara discovery and development in the late 70s. I didn't know much about the oil industry growing up. You know, there was some significant gas finds off the south coast of Ireland, Kinsale gas field, much later in the 80s, I suppose, by which time I was kind of already on a track to get into geology. I guess, you know, going to university, studying geology was more of just an interest in science and maths and things, you know, scientific, and a kind of interest in the environment. And it led me into, I kind of naturally gravitated towards oil, I think. That was because of the technology and I guess some of the studies I did. Sure, you'll be familiar, Kenny, you know, your part of the world. There's a lot of people working in the oil industry over the years. And, there's, you know, there's a whole range of jobs. But there's some really interesting work they do in using geophysics in drill holes, and they take measurements. Mark, they use it's it's called wireline. They basically drop a long cylindrical tool in a drill hole. Now these drill holes for oil are deep, right? They go down, you know, kilometers, and they don't core. Now, I don't want to get too technical, but they're percussion holes, so they just create a hole, and then just chips come up in the drilling muds. So they don't get a very clear picture. So they use these tools, wireline tools, to give a much better image of what's in the hole. So the guys can understand what's the geology, where are they, try and figure out if they're, you know, are they into a trap in a system where they can potentially find oil and gas. So I kind of got into that. And my first actual job out of uni, my first professional job was with Schlumberger, which is a big services company, you know, big global company. And they're into all sorts around the oil industry and other aspects, but their core business is around wireline, which is this acquisition of data from drill holes, and in seismics. And seismics is where you put sound waves into the ground or into the sea and then into the seabed. It's basically same sort of technology as ultrasound. You know, when you have a woman's pregnant and they want to look at the fetus.
Yeah.
Using sound waves to give a picture. Well, that's a technology they use in the oil field to try and understand, you know, whether there's traps, fault structures, sort of domes that where gas and oil can collect deep in the earth's surface, but on, you know, under the sea or on land. So basically what happened, I spent a couple of years working at Schlumberger, and I was all on, you know, into the whole the geology and the geophysics of it. But, you know, I actually ended up working in an office 90% of the time in an office in London. You know, I was very focused on data management. There was a limited amount of analysis, and, you know, and I was early in the job. I mean, I was just starting out, but very limited. What I thought I would be doing would be working on oil rigs. So actually, in some instances, people would look at it and say, oh, you lucked out. You got a really nice job, well-paid job in London, and you're sitting there in a fancy office and you travel around to different cities. Like, you know, you get to see lots of different data, a few rig visits here and there. But actually, it was kind of, it was a bit, it wasn't as hands-on maybe as I wanted to be doing. Mm-hmm. So, what happened was Anglo-American Gold Division, as it was, what became Anglo Gold Ashanti, they were applying this seismics, this ultrasound technique to look at their deep level gold mines in South Africa. So they turned up in the office one day, and I was given the task of taking care of them, you know, running the computers. It's very high tech, you know, fancy computers, fancy screens, all this fancy software. And I really had very little. I had a very brief, you know, maybe one lecture on the Wits goldfields. You know, I had a fairly limited sort of idea in my head as to, you know, what it meant. I mean, I knew that there was big gold mines down there, and of course they'd been really, you know, important in the 80s, and some huge, you know, huge resources. I mean, we're talking billions of ounces. I think a couple of billion ounces of gold that's come out of the Wits, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a serious, like 2 billion ounces, something like that, something of that order. And there's probably another billion or 2 billion in the ground. So these guys are they're looking at their 3D seismics, and I'm helping them go through the data. And as we're doing it, I'm realizing that, you know, these guys are mining down here at 2.5 kilometers below surface. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm scratching my head, you know, and I'm looking at this data and this seismic volume. So imagine, like, it's a cube of information. Mm-hmm. In there are all these faults, and you can see all this noise, and the noise is where you have gaps in the earth, where the stopes, where they're actually mining the physical ore. And of course, you can imagine say they're mining at 2.5 kilometers below surface, and there's a 1 or 2 meter gap in the rock. Well, when the sound waves are traveling through the rock and then they intersect this stope where the ore is coming at, it interferes with the sound waves. And so mm-hmm. you can physically see the location of the look. It's not absolutely crystal clear. There's a lot of interference, and it's, and the data has to be processed and so forth. But there they are. These guys are down there in the ground. And what I was used to looking at was big data sets from, you know, West Africa or North Sea. And there'd be like, you know, 5 or 10 exploration holes drilled into it. And that was the limit of the data, and lots of data. But here in South Africa, these guys are in the ground, 2.5-3 kilometers underground, and they're working within these seismic volumes, and they're looking to expand and extend into the volume that has been acquired in this 3D seismic. So I was just kind of like, wow, this is incredible. You know, and of course, what they were doing was pretty impressive. But for me, more personally, was they extended, like, you know, they offered like, well, do you want to come? Yeah. And I was like, yeah, I'll come, you know. And a lot of people thought, you know, that was a bit of a rash sort of decision. But I guess, you know, your early 20s, you're up for a bit of adventure.
Definitely.
London's not all that for a young geo. Africa's maybe sounds interesting. South Africa for sure. And then just the tech, you know, the kind of the work challenge. Well, when I got there, of course, you know, things were, it's the mines, you know, it's tough down there. And it's not all fancy machines in a fancy office in London. It's coloring pencils, and it's 1 in 200 sections, and it's up at 5 in the morning, down the pit with, you know, a few thousand other guys. And but it was a very rewarding experience, and it suited me, because it meant that I could get my hands on to, you know, there was a lot more responsibility, and there was opportunity to do projects and to get, you know, to get really involved in stuff. And so I spent a number of years with Anglo Gold, and we had, you know, using that seismics, I had a really nice experience where in the late 90s, 2000, I got married and I relocated up to Johannesburg, and I was commuting to they gave me an expansion project, and we used the seismics to do some big design changes. And that was mm-hmm. really rewarding, because it's often like, you know, the case that these designs, mine designs, can, you know, be in place for years and they don't change much. But we actually changed the design quite radically for this expansion section that I was responsible for. And it's actually, that was in 2000, say 2001, 2002. And it's mostly mined out now. I mean, I think it's Umpeneng. It's the deepest mine in the world now. I think today it's just over 3,800 meters below surface, the deepest point, which is pretty deep.
Yeah.
When I was there, we were down to about 3,700. So I had three levels: the 113, 116, and 120 levels, which was my patch. And we changed the design on two of those levels, 113, 116. And if you're ever talking to a South African miner, well, 120 basically is short for 12,000 feet. That's the kind of where the level names come from in South Africa. So 12,000 feet below surface.
So, how long does it take you to get from the bottom of the mine to the surface? It must be a long time.
It takes a bit of time. It depends. A lot of it depends on, you know, there's a lot of shift changes, right? Everything comes up out of a mine through its, to the shaft, like a deep level vertical shaft. You typically have a series of, you know, a main shaft and a vent shaft. So the air in circulates through the mine and then out, kind of in a simplistic way. There's a whole reticulation of air. And then you're going to have a series of sub shafts. Like, there's physical limits to how deep a shaft can be. Subsequent to Anglo Gold, I went to join the Placer Dome Western Area JV. That we were equipping and getting a new shaft system ready for production. The twin shaft, South Deep it's called now. It's that's a 2,976 meter deep shaft. And when we were equipping that, and that was I suppose you're traveling in a it depends what you're traveling in. When it's fully equipped and they've got these stacked cages that carry people. They're traveling in the region of 30, 40 kilometers an hour. So, but then you get to the bottom of your level. It's, you know, they obviously organize it so that you've got a stack of people all going to the same kind of place. But then when you get to the lowest levels, you normally have to walk a few hundred meters or even a kilometer, and then you get to a subshaft system, which is just going to be the same thing but underground. So sometimes you've got two and three subshafts, or perhaps a main shaft, a subshaft at depth, and then a decline system. Because what will happen is the original mine will be envisaged as a certain depth to access a certain amount of ore. And then once all that capital is sunk over 20 or 30 or 40 years in the life of some of these mines, then, you know, you're looking at a decline system where, so your shaft is actually a tunnel that's at an angle down, maybe along the dip of the ore body. But yeah, it can take, I mean, I think the first mine I worked on was a 8-shaft Great Noligwa. They changed names. That one, I think it was, I remember you take two shafts, and then it was a train. There was like a train, right? Like a little mini train. And I remember it'd be like 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and you'd be having a little snooze on your way to the inn. And, you know, kind of nice and warm down there, you know, kind of, you know, 35, 40 degrees centigrade and 100% humidity, pretty pleasant. I had a really good experience of it. I mean, it was tough. What I realized with that job that I was talking about at Mponeng was I got much more into the mining. Initially, I was doing underground work to just experience and understand the job, and then the job was very technically specialized in terms of the size. Okay, when I went to Mponeng, I'd just gotten married. There was we just moved to Johannesburg. Then there was a baby on the way. You know. And all of this was happening, and life was all a bit more serious. And suddenly there was quite a serious job. You know, it was a really interesting time, but I was mining as well. We weren't production mining now, but I was doing development. And it was a much wider sort of range of responsibilities, dealing with, you know, the drilling, dealing as part of the project team, you know, under the expansion. There was a mine manager for that part of the mine. So you're on a kind of equal footing to the engineering, the mining guy, and the, you know, the sort of environmental safety and health, and that was the really interesting experience for me. I got very interested in project management when I moved from Anglo to the Placer Dome job. That was a very small sort of management team, and it kind of took me away from that very specialized geological, geophysical sort of function into a much wider, you know, range of responsibilities, contract management, and just management, I suppose. I started doing like an MBA part time, you know, in project management. It started with AngloGold, where, you know, it's a big organization with a lot of, you know, training and professional development, right? So the project management was sort of, you know, it was earmarked largely for the engineers, you know. That was just sort of the way things were. And then I was, and it's funny, I still meet some of the guys, and they're scattered around, you know, there's guys still in Johannesburg, there's guys in Perth. I still meet, you know, from time to time at conferences, I'll meet a guy that I was with on like some of these project management courses, you know, mining engineers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was a bit of, I was the kind of odd, you know, the black sheep. I was the geo, you know, which was a bit of an unusual. But I think I got more into that side of things, and that was for me enjoyable. And I think that's what I really enjoy about mining and exploration is it takes you know, quite a wide range of skills to get a job done. And I guess that's one of the more interesting things about mining and the impact that mines have on communities. And it's an industry that I enjoy. Following the mining experience, I made a decision that I was going to now try out exploration. So I went off to the Eastern Limb looking for platinum, working on contract for Anglo Plats on the Eastern Limb of the Bushveld. And then this all coincided with a move then to Cape Town. It was for family, for the young family, to give them the opportunity to live in a nice city and that. and things were really taking off in Africa, in Southern Africa, in the exploration and mining space. So working up in Africa, and I mean sub-Saharan, outside of South Africa, so Zambia, Botswana, Malawi, these kind of countries, I could do that from Cape Town. And I sort of carried on with that from, I started in 2005. And that's where I got involved in companies that had yet to be listed. So African Energy was the one. And we were basically, you know, everything was flying. Obviously the gold price, uranium was moving from, I think, something like $20, $25 a pound in 2004 to the peaks of 125, say in 2008, 2000, you know, before the financial crash. But so I set myself up doing that with some really good guys out of West Perth. And in that time, I'd met John Teeling in Botswana. And they were trying to develop the Karowe 4 project, which he eventually, so he had African Diamonds. I mean, they're still busy with diamonds in Botswana and South Africa, Botswana Diamonds. James Campbell's the CEO there.
I know James, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's part of the kind of 162 kind of camp, you know, we share some common directors and a lot of common investors and so forth. So he was there. They were battling to get that done, and they did get it done. And then subsequently sold it to Lucara. So it was a real success. That, and I'd met him there briefly at a Botswana mining conference. And I, you know, at the time, I mean, I really wasn't thinking about Ireland too much. You know, it's 15 years ago, right? So, but I was, maybe a little less than that, but it was interesting to see that there was Irish guys out here doing stuff, and they'd been in West Africa as well. There was Ken Mayer, who were in Mozambique. And I guess I was more focused on the South African and the Australian stock, you know, ASX and those projects because of the connections I had. But slowly over time, I became involved with people out of London. And it led to, you know, it led me to sort of stopping through London quite frequently and looking at other parts of the world as well. And Arkell basically was, a decision to relocate to Ireland. I'd say largely the original decision was made probably in 2014 or 15. I wanted to get back. I'd been away for 25 years and spend, you know, be around for my folks who are aging and that. And I wanted my kids also maybe to have an opportunity for third level in Europe, which is what's happening. Well, COVID aside, but got the eldest boys in Amsterdam now, and the other one's looking, I don't know what he's going to do yet. But and so that decision was kind of made. And then I was sort of expecting, well, I'm going to do what I do, which is, work on sort of early stage exploration and development projects, and one of these days find that mine and do that through London, you know. Mm-hmm. But more specifically, I suppose, with regard to Ireland, the zinc price was starting to really lift, you know. Mm-hmm. And what was happening, and what will always happen, and it's the cyclical nature of a lot of the commodities is, because of the crash in 2009, a lot of exploration spend and a lot of investment in like the zinc space had sort of dried up. And so the knock-on effect is that down the line, there's going to be shortages. And that's what happened. I mean, the zinc price started to move quite quickly. And I mean, sure, there was some speculation there, but there was real fundamental, you know, reasons for driving that price. And as you guys possibly know, Ireland's really one of the top places to look for zinc. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, the Tower mine, which is still going strong today and going deeper. And I'd like to talk a bit about that. Again, just talking about the seismics, going back to that old story from, when I first got involved with seismics and mining was 97. seismics was used, 2D seismics was used to identify prospective structures south of Tara. Now, the Tara mine is one of the world's, probably one of the greatest zinc resources on the planet, you know, in its day. It's mm-hmm. still producing with a 5 to 6% zinc head grade, which is lower than, you know, what it would be at its peak. But they've gone and discovered now, you know, a whole new potential mine, a whole new 20 years of mining. I'm not saying, you know, they're tunneling towards it as we speak. You know, it was a good time to be talking about coming back to Ireland. So one of the people I got in touch with when I got back was John T. And Arkell was, we were just sitting with joint ventures and the sort of limited activity on our gold project. There was Gold Ground. So I guess it's those kind of connections you make and realizing. And I think that the Dalradian experience, the Dalradian gold thing, really highlighted to me that there's, you know, there's a zinc industry in Ireland, and there are zinc mines, and there will be new zinc mines, and I'm confident of that. Vein-hosted gold in Ireland, it's there. There's evidence. And Arkell's gone and drilled gold in Donegal. Historically, in the southeast of the country, where we have the Mine River project, Wicklow, Wexford. The guys, the Romans were coming across. There's been copper and gold mining in that part of the world for thousands of years, for at least 2,000, maybe 3,000, 4,000.
Yeah.
I'll always claim that it's difficult to find gold anywhere near surface in Ireland because the ground has been picked over for thousands of years by people who were motivated to find copper gold. There's stories. It's funny. I had an email just the other day from just out of the blue through the website. Someone whose great-great-grandfather had come back from California and was prospecting for gold in Donegal. And there were, you know, there was on our property up there, there's an old, it's a lead mine, lead-silver mine. Small little adit, you know, they probably took out about 3,000 or 4,000 tons total of ore, probably running at something like 10% lead, zinc, you know. Zinc would have been less of a commodity back in, you know, the 1890s, but certainly the silver had value. So there's a history there. But we're the first to go and drill for gold. To go and drill, you know, and your investors will know, people listen to this show, it's expensive to go and drill, and it's tough for it's tough to go, and you have a limited amount. Look, we're always going to have limitations in terms of budgets and so forth. So you've got to go and you've got to make very difficult decisions about, right, we're going to drill 3 holes here, and we just got to, you know, obviously the more holes you drill, the more likely you're going to have success. But depends if you're looking in the right place now, of course.
Yeah.
Where we've been looking in Wicklow, Wexford, there's been on and off exploration going on there now for 40, almost, you know, over 40 years. And, I suppose the Arkell story for me is that when I came, well, it was Connemara. I think that's the other thing. We renamed the company Arkell, but Connemara had been busy there. But we were in joint venture with a partner that had kind of, you know, had ceased to be active. And so the opportunity arose. And this just coincided, I guess, with me arriving. And I think I said that, you know, I expected to be working through London. I didn't really expect to land such a good opportunity. But here, this company was sitting, you know, with a very modest market cap, with a joint venture with Teck, who's like, you know, globally recognized zinc producer, and then and just these upside on these gold projects, which where there was things really starting to happen at Dalradian. Mm-hmm. So it was just straightforward. This is go to John Teeling, ask him for a crack at this, which is what I did.
Yeah. So moving forward to current times, Patrick. So obviously you've got two zinc projects, but obviously the Stone Park one is the flagship project, probably within the company as well. Can you just give investors that are listening a brief overview of Stone Park and the joint venture situation with Group 11, please?
Yeah. So Stone Park is absolutely, you know, in terms of value. My personal view is that Stone Park is worth certainly a lot more than our share of Stone Park is worth a lot more then maybe is reflected in the share price, in both companies, I would say. But so what happened is Group 11 had bought the project from Teck, the 76% that we didn't have, right? So they're the operator. Interestingly, the project lies, and you'll know, Kenny, but just for the listeners, the project's adjacent to another zinc project, much larger zinc project, which is Palace Green, which is Glencore on that. And Glencore's got 30 operating zinc mines around the world and one exploration project, and this is it. So it's a bit of an anomaly, but they've demonstrated very significant. There was a lot of rumors at the same time when I was looking in 2017. There was rumors that they were going to sell it, and that never came to fruition. In fact, I'm of the opinion that they're not intending to sell it at all. At any point, they've been taking care of it, and actually, it's grown significantly from about 20 million tons of resources back in when they took it from Xstrata to about 45 million now. So they spent a significant amount of money drilling it out. And what they've also done is they've invested in our partner, Group 11. So Group 11's 10% or 11% owned by Glencore. And then there's Arco, who owns the 23.44 remainder of Stone Park. So strategically, I think it's an important project because of its location. What's really important to understand about its location is literally adjacent. So there's obviously areas of higher concentration of ore, and in Stone Park North is within a few kilometers of the kind of we understand to be the concentration of ores at the north of Palace Green. What's significant is that that Stone Park is significantly shallower. So mineralization starts at about 190 meters and goes down to 400 meters, 395. And then at Palace Green adjacent, it's actually starting at 300 meters and going right down to depth. So, and also the grades, and this is very important, the grades at Stone Park and the Stone Park resource are significantly higher as well. So probably 30% higher in terms of zinc and lead contained. So to me, it was obvious just based on my mining experience, and I've obviously deep level gold mining, but I've also been around declines into the platinum on the eastern limb, and just general experience. If you look at some of the mines that have opened and since shut and been rehabilitated, Galmoy and Lachine are two famous other recent zinc mines in Ireland. They're often made up of different lobes. Okay, so you'll have different areas, and they'll be connected through mining infrastructure. And I could see that same connection between Stone Park North and Palace Green. It's completely within reason to assume that you would decline through an area where you have higher grade and it's shallower. That's what you would do. You would if you were trying to plan any mine, if you're trying to optimize any resource, you're going to try and make sure that you have cash flow up front. Mm-hmm. You'll go for that, and you'll go for the shallower, higher grade stuff, obviously, to pay off your capital as you proceed. So that was the main thing. And then the other side of it is that we have Stone Park is actually a connection of, it's six licenses, and actually all of this action at Stone Park and the resource is all in one license of the six. And so there's massive potential down in the south. And we've been working on that, and we're going to be drilling there again. And I say August, because that's the plan, but as soon as possible, we'll be drilling in other parts of the project. Those are deep opportunities, deeper opportunities. Yeah.
So for the rest of 2020, COVID alone, the sort of roadmap is at Stone Park South, there'll be a drilling campaign. Obviously, Group 11, the operators.
Well, yeah, we've announced. That's it. The money's paid up. We're ready to go. We've been constantly reviewing our position there, and there has been interest in it. But I can't go beyond that. Just that's all that's been reported, is that there's interest in the project. And that sounds a bit, There is interest. There's demonstrated interest in the project. You know, Glencore have come and purchased 10% plus of and all of the metal rights of Group 11. So that's established.
Yeah, definitely a positive. Big positive.
At some point in the future, at some point, there's going to be an optimal time for someone to make an offer or for us to seek to sell or to convert our interest in some other way. So that's I think we can see that happening. What's different about this resource is that it's sitting next door to a 45 million ton resource with a major who's demonstrated commitment to that project. So for me, that's the kind of message that that people kind of need to understand that's a really important that aspect of the resource is important. And the other side of the coin is you have the upside exploration opportunity in the south. And when we talk about deep potential, but we're also talking about massive scale. And so our partners talk about, a Navin scale. That's what they're looking for, a tier one discovery. Because if you find it, and the thing is, there's a lot of, they put together a story and it's a lot of evidence to suggest that there's a feeding structure, there's feeder structures between Palace Green, Stone Park North, between that and the areas in the south where we've had, good shows. And we've drilled a hole that demonstrated we call it the Kiltili hole, but it didn't have a huge amount of zinc in it. It had very significant zinc in terms of anomalization. It's 20 times background. It's the kind of hole that leads you to a discovery. And Galmoy and Lachine were found. They didn't get discovered on the first hole. The first holes that were drilled might have had a few points of percent in them, or less, a percent or a couple of percent. They didn't come back with the first hole at 25% like we had up at Stone Park North. But what we've got there is we've got 195 meters of core that is all mineralized, showing that there's a hydrothermal system. And what you don't get is you get zinc, but it has to be put in place, and it's put in place by a hydrothermal system. So that's exciting. And if there's a discovery there, you don't want to be missing out. If it's the feeder structure that feeds the 45 million tons and the 5 million tons at Palace Green and Stone Park North, respectively, that's the thing you're looking for. That might be the thing that can be Navin sized. And it doesn't matter how deep it is if it's Navin sized, because Navin's already down at 1 kilometer below surface, 900 meters, and they're exploring down to 1900 meters. That was what I was talking to at the start with the seismic discovery. So I believe there's a plan to mine to 1900 meters at Navin. Now start thinking about something Navin sized at Stone Park. And is it going to matter if it's 2 kilometers? No. Can we mine at 2 kilometers? Yes. Maybe we can't mine at 3 kilometers like they do in South Africa, or 3.8. And there's reasons for that. And it has to do with how hot it gets down there. So in South Africa, it would be like 50, 60 degrees Celsius at those sort of depths. In Ireland, it might be a bit hotter. I don't know for a fact, but I think it would be quite a bit hotter. And so it would just be physically impossible maybe to mark those depths.
So moving on to the gold, Patrick, obviously there's two projects. There's Main River and Inishowen in Donegal. It would be fair to say Main River's probably the flagship of your gold portfolio.
I think it's actually an interesting question, because Main River is, in terms of scale, Main River, we've put together a series of licenses there, which has, look, there's still a core, the original Tom Breen, Knocknalur area, where there's been some really good hits. We get like some good hits of 20 grams a ton. We had 16 grams a ton over 2 meters at Tom Breen. And this historic, like, it was originally discovered by Rio Tinto drilling there in the 80s. And so for me, I think we've got an opportunity there. We've got a lot of work that's kind of spaced out. There's a lot of work being done historically. There's work that we've done to try and infill, and we've developed new targets at Main River. So we'll be back at Main River, probably trenching, doing work this summer to get a bit of interest. And there's been so much interest in gold, of course, with the gold price the way it is. but also, you know, we had some interest. There was interest in other exploration in, I think, you know, in Scotland, in Ireland. The interesting thing, though, about the Donegal project is it's not now at the same scale, but we're the first to drill for gold in Donegal. So it's hard for me to say, well, you know, what's the flagship there, because they're quite different. The Donegal project in Ashon is ostensibly much more green fields, but it's located in an area where people have been, you know, thinking about quite a lot because of the very important Dalradian discovery. Well, not the discovery, that was discovered many years ago, and some of the people we've been working with were involved in that. And in fact, Gavin Birkenhager, who's the geo working with me, he spent about 3 years doing resource drilling at Coronalt, at the Dalradian project. But they've got to the point now where they're in planning permission. You know, they're seeking planning permission. I think that if a mine gets opened, 40 kilometers away, or maybe it's a little bit further than that, but across the border from Donegal in County Tyrone, I think that people will be a lot more willing to look at investing, you know, exploration funds. So I'd like to see that. But we still will be doing work. We still are doing work, in Donegal. Yeah. But for now, the next bit of work is going to be at in Wicklow, Wexford, on the border there between the two counties, at the Mine River project.
Yeah, I suppose what's key as well is these projects are both 100% owned by ARCO, which is always a big tick for me as an investor.
This is the thing. I mean, it's tough enough to raise funds to do exploration. And as I think one of the challenges with Mine River is, work's been done there in the past, and we've done some work. Like we had, but it's a large piece of ground, and if you were to bring a major in as a partner, you could probably cover a lot, but then you're giving away so much. So it's a difficult balance, isn't it? Between having, you know, ideally what you want is something where you can try and advance it as far as possible, as cheaply as possible, in terms of in terms of shareholders, capital raises and so forth.
Mark, I'm going to let you jump in here and set Patrick up for the 60-second challenge, because it rolls off your tongue better than it does mine.
Okay.
So I'll let you.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So, Patrick, what we do with when we get directors on, actually when we get anyone on the podcast, we give them 60 seconds. And it's a little bit of a challenge. I don't know if Kenny pre-warned you about this. Sometimes it's better if it's not. It's effectively a 60-second. It's your opportunity to pitch the company to investors. Why you think it's a good investment opportunity, really. So if you're up for that, I can get my stopwatch ready.
Yeah.
I think the challenge will be keeping it to 50 seconds. To 60 seconds.
I was just going to say, having listened to you wax lyrical for so long during this interview. Mark.
Yeah, we're on 59 minutes and counting. So, but what I'll do, Patrick,
we're gonna cut that down.
I'll start my stopwatch, and when it gets to like 50 seconds, I'll just give you a 10-second warning, but maybe just keep an eye on the nearest second hand in your area if you have one. So are you ready? I can start you. I can count you in.
Count me in.
Okay, so 3, 2, 1, off you go.
Okay, so Arkel is focused on gold and zinc exploration and development in Ireland. And what's interesting about Ireland is we've got a track record of mining, over 50 years of serious zinc mining and some of the best zinc resources on the planet, talking about Tara. Low sovereign risk in an established mining jurisdiction. We've got very low operational and corporate overheads, and we aim for, you know, modest, low cost exploration, effective exploration, but that doesn't cost the bank. On that note, we've got the two gold projects, which are 100% owned, and we you know, we think in a very interesting part of the world, certainly with some of the gold developments in the Dalradian area. We've also got resources as well as great exploration potential with our joint venture partners at the Stone Park Zinc Project. And we lie right next door to Glencore in that area. So that's my pitch. I think you should be.
That's good. Yeah, I let you go a little bit longer before saying, but yeah, you've got it. That was perfect. It's just that was pretty much exactly 1 minute. So yeah, nice little summary there of the company. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you, Patrick, for that. That's a lot of information there for listeners to digest. And so, thank you for coming on and talking to us today.
No, much appreciated. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's great, Patrick. Catch up with you again soon.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.